So you would advise people move to colder climates, prepare, stow away food. What advice would you give?
Another thing is a colder climate or an isolated islands are good, because islands are isolated, generally speaking. They're isolated from a lot of traffic, hopefully. Mm-hmm. A lot of human traffic, a lot of a source of bacteria. They're geographically isolated. And if they get a lot of rain, then you've got fresh water. If they have a lot of underground lava tubes or caves, then you have protection from high winds when they occur. And they have a lot of sunlight because they're in lower latitudes to experience a lot of sun, and food can grow very quickly, and grow back quickly.
Yeah, I was going to say, if these winds descend on the central latitudes, then there will be climate changes elsewhere as a result of that. And so areas that previously have not been able to grow food might be able to, or areas that have been arid will be wet, or what other changes will result from this?
Not sure. Just storms, vicious storms, and chaos. I would not take it too much of a chance in trying to predict what might change and where might change. Because there'll be no continuity for crop growing unless you get crops into a place where they're protected and the light is maintained and controlled.
Key phrase is chaos, then.
Key phrase is survival. We need to be able to plan for survival. Food, growing food, the way we do now, is not survival-oriented anymore.
So rather than worrying about storing food up and having a big cache of food, as people would be tempted to do, you're more inclined to advise people to devise safe and new ways to grow that food, because you're going to have to last a long time.
Yes, as communities and as governments, responsible governments. Yes, that's what I'm suggesting. But that's based upon a technology that taxpayers paid for, which is still very, very unknown, and in some circles construed to be the occult. So this is a hard sell on my part. It's much easier for us to find Unabombers and things like that and convince people that it's real than it is to try to sell doom and gloom.
Well, I would think the people that know your track record, the people that you worked with listening to this, their eyes must be getting wide and their heartbeat must be quickening.
That was an old boy network consisting of captains of industry that did contract with the military-industrial complex. Yes, many government officials were there too, many congressmen. And so there is an audience for that kind of thing, yes.
What bothers me is that of what you speak, all the first signs are already there. For example, the hurricane season last year, the unending, I watched the Weather Channel by the day, and I've watched it, but weather has been a hobby of mine for years. I used to chase tornadoes, and there are tornado boxes all over the place. Tornadoes and tornadoes and tornadoes as I have never seen before across North America. Again, the beginning of this, I take it.
Well, we're looking at first economic catastrophe here. Let's face it, we're not going to have the money to be able to repair the kinds of damages that any more of these vicious storms will cause. So our economy will be shot first before our infrastructure, the rest of our infrastructure. It's going to get grim, particularly in the next 4.5 to 6 years. We're looking at very, very serious conditions environmentally.
Now, I saw somebody ask you on one of the programs that was on the videotape.
I think that might have been on the Discovery Channel, The Real X-Files, the two-story of America's psychic spy.
Well, they called it The Real X-Files.
Mm-hmm.
They said that, they asked you, well, okay, then why haven't you predicted the stock market? Why haven't you predicted lottery numbers? And your answer was that those are very small spikes in the future, and that they're much harder to read, and that you see the larger events much more clearly. Is that true?
Very clearly. Our students early in the game can take a look at large earthquakes, volcanism, those kinds of things quite easily, because the event's happening now. It's a huge event. All of us are events, really. But that's an event that geological, geophysical events are very big. It's as if our unconscious is alerting us to, for survival reasons, to be on the lookout for these kind of things. Like maybe we're tuned into cataclysms of a geophysical nature more than we are other things. But that's just speculation on my part.
All right. Not speculation is something we're going to talk about next. And as you know, I live adjacent to, in fact, we have the closest broadcast facility to an area called Area 51. It has been the object of great fascination for American people for a very long time. And you know something about Area 51, don't you?
I'll give you the scoop on 51.
All right, coming up next, you've got several minutes, so relax. Major Ed Dames from SciTech is my guest. There is more, if you think you can handle it. One, everybody's dying to know, what are they doing, what have they done, what are they doing at Area 51?
All right, Area 51 is a test site. They don't build anything there per se. There may be modifications, but remember, it's a testing area.
Right.
Things are built somewhere else and brought in. Okay. There's a reason why there's that kind of secrecy exists, and I'm going to talk about that. That level of secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
You're dealing with nuclear weapons, and in defending the nation against nuclear weapons, you need to have things that are protected, operationally secure, as well as secure in other ways, too. Let me be specific. There is a set of satellites out there that many of your listeners know about called DSPs, Deep Space Platforms. Satellites look down on the planet Earth, particularly places other than the United States,
right,
for signs of an intercontinental ballistic missile launch,
right,
as well as other missile launches.
Right.
They can see the hot flame of a missile, and they can see other things that are classified.
Right.
Signatures and... missile is launched, it is extremely difficult to interdict that missile.
That's right.
By the time we get around to doing it, we may or may not be able to intercept, and if we do, we don't know whether we're intercepting a decoy and wasting precious anti-ballistic missile defenses against a decoy or the real thing. We have real problems there. So, what to do? If we see somebody allegedly gearing up to launch one, do we launch for a strike or to preempt it? If someone is getting ready to launch, a potential adversary is getting ready to launch a preemptive strike against the United States, and all indications to our intelligence community, our indications and warning community say that that's going to happen, what do we do? Well, the answer is we wait. We wait until we see the missile take off. Now, that means we have to have an effective anti-ballistic missile defense for the United States,
right,
or we have to do something else. And that's something else, is what goes on in Area 51. There is another way to defend, or attempt to defend, which is almost impossible, against missiles once they go ballistic and once they enter the Earth atmosphere over North America. We really can't defend effectively against them. But there's something else that we can do. If we can get to a missile launch site fast enough before an ICBM gets into the upper levels of the Earth's atmosphere,
mm-hmm,
we can kill it there in the enemy's own country and potential adversary's own land. Now, you have to move really fast to do that, and you run into all kinds of problems. But when people like Ben Rich and the Skunk Works back years ago got together to build some really esoteric devices, satellites and SR-71s and all kinds of wonderful things, they pulled together a group of very eclectic thinkers, brilliant engineers, who really didn't work well as a group. But if you really babysit these individuals and you're a good project manager, individuals, very brilliant engineers working together, they can come up with objects that, for all intents and purposes, appear to be alien. And that is, in fact, what's happening at Area 51. You're seeing the limits of our technological base being pushed. Because people, these engineers, theoretically, can develop all kinds of things that can exceed most of our wildest dreams, but we're limited by our material sciences predominantly to what we can build. But still, when you build something that flies like a bat out of hell and it's coated with diamond-coated surfaces, very expensive, can move at levels of Mach 18, something very fast, you can take it off from the United States or U.S. held territory beyond the ground and in the area, in the neighborhood of an ICBM that has just taken off. Kill it, disable it, and come back home. What's going on there. This is the nation.
I believe it.
This is our nation's Sunday punch.
We've been talking for I don't know how long and getting rumors and more than rumors of craft that are flying in from the Pacific at incredible speeds.
Well, and these, I mean, we have some very brilliant engineers in it. They've been asked to come up with things that can... That was their task. We have to be able to disable or kill intercontinental ballistic missiles while they're still rising up above a potential adversary airspace.
God, that's absolutely fascinating. So you're saying with a fast response, you could get one of these incredible craft to a location where an ICBM is rising and knock that damn thing down above the country
moving
that launched
like,
it.
That's right, moving like a bat out of hell. Now, there's a lot of problems technologically and engineering-wise when you do that. For instance, you have an ionized plasma that surrounds, in many cases, surrounds the shell, the skin
right.
of a vehicle that's moving that fast, unmanned,
right.
by the way.
Right.
And now how do you communicate with it? So that's something you have to overcome. And,
so like the re-entering astronauts that go through a blackout period.
That's correct. That's the speeds get like at that or greater. There's another problem. One of the reasons that things are so classified in this arena are because of the toxicity of the fuels. The Environmental Protection Agency would never allow an operation like that. These fuels are so poison, so very, very poison, that they could not essentially be used anywhere.
Well, again,
they could not be disposed of effectively.
Again, there's something there, because there is a lawsuit underway right now by a number of people who have worked at Area 51.
Yes, my vice president, Jonina Tarif, has informed me of that a couple of weeks ago.
So it's underway, and they claim they were toxically poisoned.
Yeah, the fuels are, there's a mixture of two fuels, actually. There's a spontaneous combustion, the Aurora, for instance, the engines outside of the craft after it gets to a certain modality of operation. And there are follow-on vehicles that are more esoteric, that use the attempted electrogravitational propulsion, those kind of things that people see hovering about the Area 51. All these are physics is physics, and we'll build stuff that can increase our capabilities to deliver this kind of Sunday punch, because that threat's still very real out there. Aliens, nope, sorry. Are there extraterrestrials out and about? You bet, but not there at Area 51.
All right. I've got a series of questions posed by facts, and there's a lot of good ones here.
Wait, I'm not done yet.
All right, go. Oh, well, by all means, go.
Okay, about the government's hidden UFO agenda, there's one other thing I'd like to talk about here, and that is what we're hiding. If you remember Howard Bloom's book, Out There?
Yes.
Which was fairly poorly written, but he talked about a UFO working group in the Pentagon.
Right.
I was a member of that. We even had a cover name for it to disguise ourselves. We call ourselves the Advanced Theoretical Physics Working Group.
Oh.
And essentially, we had no charter to look at the UFO phenomenon. There was no money. There was no charter. We tried to hide our activities under General Abramson's Star Wars program, the SDI program. Essentially attempting to develop software that could recognize something differentiated between alien, airliner, satellite, those kinds of things. And those members were military officers. I was the youngest, the junior officer at the time, and there were members of the military industrial community that were there too, Lockheed Missile and Space, McDonnell Douglas, companies of that ilk. And we were a bunch of wild and crazy guys who were sincerely interested in looking at this phenomenon, but could not coax money out of presidents or services to really do anything with it. Why? Because there's no charter. After Project Blue Book and a few follow-on projects, there's really no national security threat there. And the Department of Defense and the intelligence agencies are tasked with protecting the nation against other nations or potential adversaries.
Right.
There isn't any charter, and so there's no money for that. It has to be put into the civilian in a community, research. Charter doesn't exist, congressionally or otherwise, to look at UFO things. Now, our satellites did pick up photos that pick up things, glowing objects hovering above bases, both ours and other countries. And those are real photos. They are really glowing objects that defy explanation and are enigmatic, that have been captured on satellite photography, but they will not be released because they cannot be released. Number one, the place that we were looking at, those kinds of data are classified, what we are looking at any given time.
Major, there was a 2020 program, I think it was 2020,
mm-hmm.
in which they documented objects that had appeared above Soviet missile silos. And as a matter of fact, one of them activated the launch sequence for a Soviet ICBM. And they continued to document that there was this object above, and they went into launch sequences, no question about it. The Russians totally freaked out, tore everything apart. I mean everything. Every panel out of there after this incident tried to find out what had happened. And there were no answers. No answers. And there have been stories of objects hovering above our sites as well.
That's true. But I want to get back to that is correct. Those events have happened. They are real. They are extraterrestrial in nature. I don't want to go too deeply into that now, except I want to make sure that we understand that the government isn't hiding anything vis-a-vis that. The satellite photography that can't be released is because of, we do not want to give away, as I don't watch a lot of television, but if they suggested that some of these photographs can't be released because it would divulge the capabilities of the satellite, then that's correct. That's the reason that it's so classified. Some of those, and that's of the only evidence that we have, other than Arts Park, of allegedly alien activity.
Yes.
Now, there have been very, very enigmatic things happen at U.S. bases, but they remain unexplained. And any government that purports to have control of its populace or maintain control of its citizenry is not going to release a report that says, we don't know what this is. You and I both understand the reasons why for that.
Let me tell you a little story about Gordon Cooper, the astronaut. He said that he was at Edwards Air Force Base when a military film team was filming something or another, regular duty, and they were out on a flight line, and they saw a craft come down, three legs extend, the damn thing landed on the ground, they kept rolling, they had film of it, this is Gordon Cooper now, and they started moving toward this craft, it rose into the air, the three landing wheels or whatever it was, extended into the craft, and it just shot straight up. Well, they had all this on film, they sent it to Washington, according to Cooper, where it disappeared for all time.
Well, that sounds like one of ours. We've had things like that for many years. So why do you think we retired the SR-71. What do you think we replaced that with? We've been testing little objects like that with tripod landing gears for quite a while. What aliens use are something very, very different on. And it doesn't look like that. It's a good point,
and after all, it did come down at Edwards, which is an Air Force base.
That's correct. That's
so
correct.
You're saying that's one of ours.
Yes, that was one of ours. That was one of our prototypes, and that was the beginning of the end of the Blackbird program.
There's a fellow down in Australia, Stan Dale. I don't know if you know of Stan or have heard of him, but Stan says a lot of things about our craft, just like you're saying, that we have these things and have had them for a long time.
We take them off from one place and we land them somewhere else, just like we used to do with the SR-71. But we've continued to buy in as a populace to these conspiracy theories. I mean, I and my vice president announced at a UFO Congress in Germany that the Santilli alien is a hoax. It's a bag filled under pressure with a pump inside. Pressure's there so that when you cut it open, it looks like fluids are oozing out. You notice that there was no sound on the tapes. Actually, I have not seen these tapes. There's no sound because if there were, you'd hear the pump, the little pump that's pumping in that, keeping that bag pumped up.
Huh. Fascinating.
But we keep wanting to believe that. And meanwhile, there's something else happening. And by the way, my company is working on a report that we'll put out on our website about Lalande 21185, the star that has a solar system.
Yes.
Of the new solar system.
Yes, about 8 light years or a little better.
Yes, we've begun to take a look at that, and that's kind of an easy target for us. So we're beginning to sketch the planets around it. There are three planets. One is a gas giant. Two other small ones have their own moons, one 5, another 7 moons. And we're beginning to explore the surfaces of each one of those planets. The two small ones, planets, we call them Planet Enoch and Planet Aaron. Planet Enoch appears to have organic matter. We'll take a look at that and describe it for exobiologists, exogeologists. Planet Fiona, we call the gas giant. That'll be the last one that we survey.
With all you have to say about what has occurred to Earth and the insult to Earth, shouldn't we be expanding our space program to look toward other planets, possibly that could be inhabited by humans who don't really want to live underground?
Well, if one thinks that there might be a federation out there, I'm not so sure that federation would allow us to go out and trash another planet, right? Maybe we might have to take care of our own business here.
Yes.
Actually, I mentioned an in-house project that SciTech has, Project Starman, and I can't talk about that at this juncture. But
even in a general way?
Mars.
Mars.
That's all I can say. Watch Mars.
We'll watch Mars. All right, I do have some really interesting questions for somebody like you. One of them is, do you have anything to say about the nature of our soul? He who looks at the kinds of things you look at might be able to answer that question. Do we as humans have a soul? Do we have something that lives past the physical life, do you believe?
Yes. That field these days, the buzzword is continuity of consciousness.
Yes.
That's what the study is.
That's right.
It is one of the most fascinating projects I've ever been involved in. The jury's still out within our own ranks as to what's going on. But the answer to the question is yes, there's something that survives death. Our minds slough off, however, which is an interesting development. When we remote view a dying person, we see something split off that we call the soul, and we cannot track that. It's beyond our capabilities. We know of other places that have very strange life forms that we think might be where people are reconstructed, but we have no chain of custody. So there is a discontinuity between what leaves a dying body and what we see in other places, which we suspect might be worlds where personalities are recreated.
So there's a sort of dead zone to you.
There's a broken chain of custody and tracking one's personality essence, if you would. But our minds slough off. That's a very interesting phenomenon.
It is. Major, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. Stay right there. SciTech Major Ed Dames. I'm Art Bell, and this is the American CBC Radio Network. And that when we die, you kind of lose track of it as in a reentry period. And then it may be, is it your view that it is recycled, or do you have any thoughts on what occurs?
I don't have a lot of thoughts. It's a very difficult thing for us to do. It may seem odd that a military team would have applied itself under the rubric of advanced training to this type of thing, but I was looking for really extreme challenges, and this was the most extreme one I could find.
Oh, yes. It is the most extreme, the biggest question for mankind. All right, let's try this one out. Those who can look ahead and see big spikes ahead of us to the right, does such a person dare look ahead to their own death?
You know, it's funny you should ask that. In training, we have to be careful. A lot of times our trainees will actually give them their own lives, what we call a personal trajectory. And I have to be careful that they don't go through the protocols too rapidly, because they'll be perceiving their own death. And that can be a discomforting thing. But yes, you can perceive what appears to be, with high probability, very, very prominent milestones or peaks in your trajectory, including the end of your life.
Have you looked at yours?
No, I haven't.
I don't think I would either.
I may someday. I just think that I'd rather not know right now.
I understand
that. Not that I'm a chicken, but... I think I'd rather spend my time thinking about other things.
All right, let's look left again. Somebody down in Texas wants to know if you've ever looked back toward the big spike that would have been the presence of Jesus on Earth that time.
Yes, it's a training target. The crucifixion is a training target, and there was a real person, yes, a real man.
He was here.
Yes, Calvary is a training target that we have. It's an advanced training target. I sometimes give it as the student's first solo. That's where their skills are up to par enough on day 7 or 8 of training, where they have to work alone, and I leave the room. So they work against unknowns as well as knowns.
All right, if you can look to the left to when he was here, do you look to the right to his return?
We have not. We have not done that. There's so many things that they use this technology against, and that, actually, I haven't looked at that at all. It's not something that, it's in our thousands of training files and operational files, that is not there.
All right, something current, Major. There have been reports of a creature, I'm sure you've...
The Chupacabra.
Yes, sir, I have to ask.
It's in the docket. It's in the docket, and when we work it, we'll provide it as a report on our website.
Oh, you will?
Yes.
Would you give people, and I'm sure that Keith is quickly linking to your site, but what is your web address again, please?
Our web address is www.transition-3000.de. That is Transition 3000, and that particular distribution channel is deals exclusively with SciTech bulletins, reports, and studies. That'll be available quite shortly.
All right. What about Tunguska? That must have been a big spike in the past. The event that may have killed off the dinosaurs and a big transition point for Earth. Have you ever looked at that?
Now, Tunguska was in about 1906 or 8, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, yes, you are correct. I'm
sorry.
Not, I
meant, you're thinking
I meant
the KT.
KT event, yes.
Event. Yes, it looks as if the KT event did kill off the dinosaurs or possibly lots of things during the Jurassic. But it did something else, too, that's very interesting. It appears to have sideswiped Mars to the point where it really disabled the atmosphere and sort of set into motion a dynamic which robbed Mars of its atmosphere.
There is thought to be, and I had a physicist on the show last night, I know you heard part of it.
Yes, I enjoyed listening to part of it.
And he said that they think there may be a very great deal of ice just under the Martian surface, that which used to be water that was above ground. Now, we're getting dangerously close to your Starman program that you seem very disinclined to talk about. Yeah, that's what I thought. So, think Mars. I guess we better settle for think Mars. All right, I have asked a lot of questions.
You'll recall that both the Russians and the Americans have lost their eyes and ears around the planet Mars. And I think you remember that in August, a few years ago, we lost a spacecraft.
I recall.
And SciTech has published a report. We actually did a contract for the Russians. The Russians approached SciTech asking what happened to Phobos 2 in 1989. This was a spacecraft the Russians launched called Phobos 2, second in a series. And it met its demise shortly after entering Martian orbit in the spring of 1989, and SciTech was contracted to look at and see what happened to that spacecraft.
And what did you see?
Well, there was a very interesting machine that rose up from the surface of the planet to meet yet another machine that was in orbit, a different type. And both these machines, quite almost sentient vehicles, if you will, unmanned,
yes,
actually converged on the Phobos 2, and one actually came in contact with it. And the rest is in the report. I'll have that report out available for listeners in the next couple of months.